This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present. And you wouldn't believe it, listeners. We haven't been in studio for like 3 weeks. I mean, we recorded quite a bit before. And
yeah.
And Jonathan, was busy, wrote exams. I was not busy. But nevertheless, welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back. And while we've been away, it's no longer white Monopoly Capital. It's just Monopoly Capital now.
I also noticed that.
Mm.
Ever since Bell Pottinger protected their tweets.
Mm.
This narrative has changed completely.
I think it's also when you have tons of capital flight out of the country, then you're kind of like, shit, we can't identify the capital. Whose is it? Is it black? Is it white? No, shit, everyone's just moving money out of the country.
Yeah, most of it to Dubai, but, you know, other places too. But what is interesting about capital, the guy from KPMG, I have no idea, is he the CEO? He resigned.
Yeah,
KPMG after...
Did he resign from KPMG? Wasn't he going to be a board member at Alexander Forbes?
Right, okay.
And he withdrew his sort of position there.
After one email came out where he was like a bit flattering to the Guptas.
Yeah, he was just a little bit smarmy.
Right, he just said, the story was written about me, why is it a bit uncharitable? We talk about it?
So it makes you wonder what else there is.
But literally, that's what it said. And he resigned. Now... A lot of other emails have come out about a whole lot of politicians. No one's resigned. And somehow the private sector is evil because, it isn't, because this guy resigned after one email.
Well, yes, the private sector tends to clean up its messes better than the public sector.
Like very, very quickly. Like, yeah. I was actually quite surprised that he resigned. I mean, doesn't he know we live in South Africa? This is Africa, man. We don't resign, we die in office.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. And one other thing, just quickly, wanted to get your view on,
right,
is this Oh God ruling that no more sort of religion can be taught in public schools. I think that's
I'm against that. I think public schools shouldn't exist.
Okay, fair enough. But assuming they do, then are you for or against that ruling?
Oh, the amount of fucks I give is very little. No, I don't care. I really don't care.
I do find interesting that a lot of these situations often bring up hypocrisy. So you'll find people going, absolutely, the government must not interfere in the schools and teach religion. And that's coming from people on the left. And they're right. Yeah,
indeed.
Because they're actually inadvertently tapping into a... conservative principle, which is that the government does not belong in your personal affairs.
Right.
But
then they have
apply
to
that to healthcare, for
or
example.
Biology, or being taught biology. Right?
Yeah.
There's like 72 genders.
Yeah. Then the government must step in.
You have to impose that, of course. People are fuck-ups. What can I say? I don't know. I'm tired of caring about people's stupid arguments.
Well, talking about stupid arguments... we're going to talk about an industry that presents a lot of them today. So do you want to introduce our guest for the week?
So our guest this week is Tim Fleck, who was a member of Sandu, who was a communications director at IFP, and is now what is known as a metalsmith. So Tim, welcome to the Renegade Report, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, how's it, guys? Welcome. No, thanks for having me. Welcome to my home, obviously.
Welcome to our studio.
Oh, cool.
So,
really?
Yeah.
We sound like fucking queer for the straight guy here. Anyway.
That's latent homophobia happening right there.
Only latent, not overt.
not if you have a gay best friend.
Oh, well, Jonathan's not my friend. Anyway, Tim. The reason why we got you on here is because we've been really hard on the media, on this show particularly. And often, of course, we make broad statements and we forget. Well, we don't forget, but a lot of journalists are actually doing very good jobs. But they just don't have the Twitter following, or they don't have the reach of these other journalists who do shitty jobs but take credit for everything. So let's go... back to you in terms of your history, because you seem to know quite a few journalists. Let's go back a bit to your history. So you were first in the union for the army.
Yes, yeah. Basically, it was the biggest military trade union for the South African National Defence Force. So, I ended up getting into a little bit of trouble with the military and needed their assistance, and ended up causing a little bit of crap with the officer commanding, and the national secretary then, Pikkie Greef, asked me to come and work for him. And he said, well, I like the way you handle it. We'll solve two problems. I get a new organizer and you get to stay in Pretoria and stay with my ex-wife there at that time. Long divorce, bad idea marrying that woman. But ended up working for the union and started working very closely with journalists and in a specific kind of way, not necessarily just in terms of a communications person, dealing with like classified stuff, secret stuff, things like the Gupta landings, for example, at Waterkloof Air Force Base. That discussion happened one night. I was sitting in a bar in Simonstown after about three or four beers, and I got a little bit of a whisper. Someone messaged me and asked me if I knew anything about the landing, and I said no. And he said, well, you better check it out, because the Guptas are – I've got the authority that the Guptas are going to be landing. So that sort of stuff is things that I dealt with. And then I specifically picked certain kinds of journalists that I could see could handle the stuff that I was dealing with. Guys like Barry Bateman, obviously I handed over the Gupta stuff to him and just mentioned it to him and brought it to his attention. And I mean, he ran with it and he ran with it beautifully, because I got a phone call. I was still Bubba last the next morning at like 6:30 in the morning, and he phoned me and he said to me, you fucking rock star, guess who I'm standing next to right now. And that was the beginning of all the shit that happened in South Africa where we're sitting with now. That was when the Guptas became famous. So I mean, through that and becoming a reliable source, I worked with a lot of good quality journalists and dealing with really technical but secretive sort of stuff.
Right. And these journalists are not the ones with 100,000 followers on Twitter and who work at The Mail and Guardian, right? These are journalists that no one really knows about.
They take their job seriously. They're there to be journalists. They're not there to be Twitter stars.
And these were the guys that I worked with were people like, I don't know if you guys have heard of a guy called Graham Hoskins. He's at the Sunday Times. Catherine Child is another one that I worked with. Very, very good journalist. Glenys Underhill, she was at the Mail and Guardian. I think she's still writing for them, but also not very well known, but prominent in getting really good information and breaking stories out in the right way. Another one that's really, really, really good, and it slips the mainstream guys because she reports mainly in Afrikaans, and it's Erica Gibson. Erica Gibson, I've always wished that she would also report in English. She does sometimes, but mainly in Afrikaans for like Die Burger and reports and stuff like that. And she's got really, really good hard hitting stories. And she's got an information stream towards her like it's crazy. You phone her with anything and say, okay, I heard this. She'll phone you back in 2 minutes and say, it's bullshit. My source in frippin' Kandahar or whatever says that it's not like that, and he works on the base where this allegedly happened. So, yeah, there's a lot of journalists like that in this country that need to get a bit more recognition.
They're the ones, you know, making it about the story.
Yes, yeah. And also, if there's a story that needs to be told where information needs to be made public, they make sure that it happens, and they make sure that their sources are protected as well. So I mean, they really make sure it's a personal thing. They take it personally that the information needs to be out there and for public knowledge.
Yeah, because unfortunately we reached a stage where journalists are the story. Right. So for example,
that's the cardinal rule that they're breaking.
Right.
Journalists is not supposed to become the story ever.
I mean, that's what journalists have told me about it. And so even, just for example, for today, CNN doxed a man who created a meme that Donald Trump tweeted, right?
Yes, yeah.
And now they found him, and apparently he apologized, and they have his details.
Sounds eerily familiar.
Yeah, but well, here in South Africa, we dox people first.
Yes.
Right.
And then we interrupt them in their lunch break and make them resign.
Right. And then we film them during the lunch break like a fucking police interrogation. But CNN has a good sense not to do that. But the difference in terms of – but the, CNN has become the story.
Yeah. No, they have. And I mean, I think the only reason why it sort of gained the sort of traction that it did was because Donald Trump retweeted the video.
Yeah,
and now everyone, because it's fucking Donald Trump. Sorry, I'm going to swear a lot.
Please do.
It's fucking Donald Trump all of a sudden, and he's this like weirdo, retard, pervert kind of guy. Let's just like shaft him and pick on everyone else that tries to support him. Even though this was probably a joke, the guy created it and thought it would be funny. And it was funny. I watched it.
It was Donald not Trump funny. It was hilarious.
Memes and GIFs are funny. That's what they're there for. They're jokes. They're visual jokes. That's all they are. It seems odd to me that anyone would take them that seriously. But you know, at home we've got similar kind of news media making themselves the story. We've got ANN7, which is pretty much a network joke, a news network joke, as a propaganda sort of front. And then, of course, you know, we've had multiple sort of weird and wonderful things happening with publications like the Huffington Post. There have been points where the Mail and Guardian has hardly covered itself in glory, and that used to be the sort of premier publication.
Got IOL writing about Iqbal Swerve every 5 minutes.
Yeah, and you know, even it's interesting because there's good journalism sometimes and poor journalism other times, and I guess that's what the journalists would say. You know, we don't get it right always, and sometimes we screw it up. It just seems that there's a cult of personality, you know, which Ramon was alluding to.
Yeah. Look, there definitely seems to be that sort of thing popping up. Some of these journalists that are out to get their names out there and to chase the next big fit, and I call them they've joined the professional outrage brigade. Right. There seems to be this trend where everyone's professionally outraged, and now journalists are jumping on that same. Certain journalists are jumping on that same bandwagon, and they're creating even more storm around these idiots on Twitter that freak out about some dude farting on the side of a street, and there happened to be someone of color standing behind them, and all of a sudden, fucking, he's a racist, sort of thing. So, I mean, these guys are jumping on these bandwagons, and they're fueling the fire even more. And I was speaking to someone the other day, and they said to me that there always seems to be this kind of, in South Africa particularly at the moment, there's this like low key, and I think I spoke to you about it, Ramon, as well. This low key sort of new kind of civil war being fought at the moment, and it's being fueled by some of these journalists. They're adding fuel to the fire, and they're making it worse when it's actually not that bad. Same with Shirley Garland, for example. It was a perfect example of them having made a stuff up, but then instead of rectifying and saying I'm sorry, they fueled it even more and made it a whole race thing.
True. I mean, and that's the thing about Bell Pottinger, right? Let's go back to them. A lot of people give them grief. I quite like following their timeline. I haven't been blocked, by the way. I'm one of the few in the country. Obviously,
I can't believe it.
Me neither. Nevertheless, I follow
the only
them.
People who haven't blocked you are Bell Pottinger.
So they created the whole narrative about white men not a capital and racism and all that, which is fine, whatever. But it would never have gotten hold of the narrative if the media didn't buy into it in the first place or reported on it in the first place.
Or believed it.
Indeed. I mean, Bell Pottinger was the spark, and then they were just the fucking fuel on top of it.
Well, that's the thing. Bell Pottinger knew that was going to happen. They knew the media was going to jump on it, and look, that was the next fad and the next 2 weeks of outrage. And Bell Pottinger knew about it, and they used it to their advantage. So they just dropped one little penny, and everyone else ran off with it. And then you had Jimmy Money, who was obviously being paid by the Guptas to keep pushing the narrative. And then people go and some of these journalists will go and retweet Jimmy Money and make him even more famous. The same as Andile
Gupta Tama. Listen, Tim, we white, I don't give a fuck how you pronounce it. I can't pronounce it, so I don't give a fuck. Anyway.
He wouldn't pronounce Ramon Cabernet properly, so
there's
I guess.
Black people that don't even know how to pronounce his name properly. So, I mean...
Yeah, but he's a good example, actually. Here's this thug, a drunkard, who grew up on a farm somewhere, right, who joined the EFF and they kicked him out for being a drunkard. And now
he sold his original movement out first to join the EFF.
Indeed, indeed. And but all he is a thug with a very good, appetite for alcohol. And all he does is say land or death and everyone's a racist. And it's like Bell Pottinger 101. And we still give him the time of day. Why?
Well, I mean, he got a taste of this, of the 70,000 rand a month that he was earning in Parliament. And then when that was taken away from him, he all of a sudden crapped himself. And he went begging to the Guptas like everyone else in the country has been doing. I mean, we saw it in the media how many politicians have gone to his house to have gone to the Guptas' house to have lunch with him. Yeah, so sure. He did exactly the same as them. He went begging, and because he's got this outrage factor to him, because he says things like, necklace someone, or I read something the other day about him saying about something about matches and the wind and farmers and shit like that. Sort of stuff is, and people jump onto it, retweet it, and then say, "Oh, Andile said this."
But the thing is Twitter, we know, is a very small platform. Actually, it has relatively little sway. It's essentially where the bourgeoisie spend their time virtue signaling. What occurs to me is that journalists have an incredible amount of power, which we as a society want them to have, because the whole concept of the fourth estate, they are the check on power. We give them that power to be able to put people's name in lights or black and white, and in so doing they get to tackle every other form of power, and that's the sort of dynamic that is set up. The issue is that it seems as if now the interest is not in being the best in the best interest of the public, but rather pushing a certain narrative. So, for example, because there's a very sort of left-leaning press in South Africa for the most part, they'll be happy to push these sort of neo-Marxist ideas around race, for example, and oppression. And so they love these stories. We're talking about Bell Pottinger and that they just basically dropped a seed and the media ran with it and allowed publication of editorials in their newspapers and opinion columns from people like Money. How do you see that check on power? Because the media sort of screams the minute you say we want to kind of stop you from being irresponsible, and I understand why they get upset about it. Same as us get upset with people saying we want to check your freedom of speech. They say, well, don't check the freedom of the press. Where do you think that line is? How do we get back to a point where journalists are reporting the real story as it is, and not where they want it to go?
Well, I think these sort of, let's call them populist journalists that you're talking about, some of them, we need to stop giving them the time of day, reacting to their stuff, just basically letting them say whatever they want to say. Eventually, they're going to realize that what they're saying is irrelevant, and no one really gives a fuck. That's one of the ways to do it. Another way is also to call them out on their bullshit. And I know it causes some sort of trouble, because if you call out some journalists on their bullshit, you end up with all their followers sort of that agree with them, sort of hammering you on the other side. So
yeah, and you sometimes give more fuel to the fire, because they've created a small fire of something, and then you argue with them, and they get to spin it into 17 more columns down the way.
And then another way would be to people – there's a lot of people that give stories to journalists. Handpick who your journalist is. Have a group of four or five journalists that you know will do the right thing and give them the story instead of giving it to someone who – because a lot of people will say, oh, I have to give this to – let's say, for example's sake, let's use Carte Blanche as an example. whenever there's something really bad happening, a lot of people will say, oh, this must go to carte blanche. It must go to carte blanche. And they get inundated with all these massive stories. And they have a choice whether they can pick or choose the worst ones or not. But if you pick these other journalists and give them the better stories, they're going to start getting a bit more prominent. But they'll also be true to themselves the way that they've always been. They're not going to turn around and think that they're better than everyone else or carry on the way these other guys are doing.
So if we go back to our original premise about there's like sort of two types of journalists, right? Some that do the story and some who want to be the story. From the journalists that you know, the ones that we agree are good, is there a tension between the so-called popular journalist and the ones that are doing the work? Is there a tension there, even in the same organizations?
I don't think so. I think the guys that are doing the jobs don't really care about these other guys because they're there to do one thing. They're there to do their jobs. They're not there to sort of roll their eyes every time one of their popular colleagues kind of says something stupid or reports something stupid. So they're just there for one thing. They're there to do their jobs, and then they believe in the profession that they're working. So I don't think there is really a tension between them.
Okay. And
you'll probably see it from the popular ones. The popular ones will, if you start giving better stories to their more traditional colleagues, they'll probably be the ones that are spiteful, sort of thing, and there'll be resentment towards the ones doing the job.
Right. So the original point of this discussion was to talk about your friend who passed away recently. Her name was Sine Fenta. She was one of the SABC 8.
Yes. Yeah.
And she died from a suspected medical condition last week. So just based on your history with her, can you just give us a little bit of what her character was? Like, how did she approach the work that she did?
Fearlessly. She was fearless in dealing with problems and in dealing with the work that she did. She wasn't scared to do a job at all, and it didn't matter the outcome of it either. For example, she wanted to go and report on what was happening in Syria. So she used her own money to go over to Turkey, and then she snuck over the border. She smuggled herself over the border. I believe she got shot at by Turkish police on the way out as well. And on her own with a couple of smugglers, she walked for 3 days to where she was going, and then she came back again. Another one was Yemen. She reported on what was going on in Yemen. Another one, when the Israelis were attacking Palestine in this last round. Well, I don't know if there's been any since then, but the last televised one, she went over on her own again as well and used her own money and reported for the SABC. On events that were happening there. So I mean, she was she was brave. She really had a lot of courage, and she wasn't scared to do what she believed in. A very kind person, a very soft person too. She was very soft spoken as well. But I've never met anyone that's and I mean, she didn't give a shit if people were listening into phone calls or anything like that. She was hardcore.
Right. So, I mean, I don't want to – the reason why we don't talk about this is because in a liberal democracy, it's not usual for journalists to die at the age of 32 of a suspected medical condition brought about by stress. Yeah. So there's been a lot of rumors and allegations about what had happened to her since the SABC 8 moment. So can you just explain what SABC 8 was? And what consequences flowed from that?
Okay, what happened was, I don't know if you remember, Hlari Motsoeneng.
Of course.
A very, very special man, future president of South Africa, as he sees himself. Anyway, King Hlari decided one day that it was time to tell good news. And I don't know if you remember, and it stems back to what Zuma said, president, oh, sorry, before I piss someone else off. President Jacob Zuma said a couple of years back.
Is he Atul Gupta's deputy?
Yeah, he's the deputy president of the country. Karine Duplessis was tweeting about an event that Zuma was speaking in about the media. And Zuma had just gotten back from Mexico. And he was saying, oh, Mexican journalists are wonderful. They only report the good news. And, oh, South African journalists must be exactly like that. They must just report the good news because we have a good story to tell. And to tie it into moving forward and the ANC's moving forward and better story to tell and all that crap that just never happens. And I think Saudi decided, no, well, let's take a picture out of that book. And he said, no, that no more protest action was going to be reported on. Now, if you look at protest action in South Africa, and this is where it comes back to also when I said the slow-scale civil war sort of being waged. A couple of years ago, there were maybe a few hundred protests in a year. There were a lot, but not that many. This year, there's been more than a couple of hundred protests. And let's put Africa Check on it. They can go and check how many protests there were and put out in the last, say, 5 years, the number of protests a year. And there's been more protests now than ever before. And I think Claudie didn't want this to tie into the other narratives or assumptions that could be made from it. And he said that at the SABC, there will be no there'll be no footage shown of protest action anymore. And this is where the shit hit the fan. A lot of journalists decided that this is not on at the SABC. Suno was one of them. Futa Kriche was another one. Jacques Steenkamp, the Kravani Pillay, I think, was one of the other ones. And they decided, no, that they were going to protest this. The Right to Know campaign started protesting outside the SABC, and they were told not to report what was going on outside as well. So these journalists decided to join in, and they actually got placards, wore black, and they taped their mouths shut with a cross. And it started off a storm because a lot of the journalists, and if you look back on that, it's also the journalists that aren't in real public limelight. Yeah, the ones that the popular or famous ones did it too. But a lot of other journalists popped out of the woodworks that most people didn't really know of. And producers and stuff like that, they worked in it. And they started posting their pictures with the duct tape on their mouths. And this is where the shit happened. And Claudie decided, no, well, these eight guys are going to get fired. And he suspended them. The HR guys at SABC decided that they were going to turn a blind eye to procedure not being followed. The lawyers decided not to look at anything like turn a blind eye and just let it happen. And the eight of them were fired. On the spot. So, I mean, that's where they became the SABC 8.
Right, right. And then they went to court. I think they had an application to court, and the court said their dismissal was unlawful. And they went back to work, if I remember correctly.
They went back to work. Barful won. I think Vuyo Mvoko was, because he was a stringer, he wasn't reinstated. So he was freelancing, I think.
Right.
But the rest of them were sent back, and one of them's resigned, and he's like, fuck this shit, I'm out, and he went to New Zealand. So
right.
So I mean,
so what happened to Sine and her colleagues in the SABC 8, the ones that remained, of course, after they went back to work?
With Suna and the rest of them, they called him. What happened was Claudie and his cronies, there was a small group of them that decided they were going to run the show and cause crap. And they started having, let's call them rats, within the ranks of the SABC, who would report back to what were known as enforcers. Suna in her testimony called them enforcers. And these enforcers would then go and report back to Claudie or carry out his orders on them. And they were victimized a lot at work. Bad rumors specifically about Suna were spread around. Things like she was psychologically unstable and that she was imagining things were happening to her. But, I mean, out of all of them, they all were receiving death threats. They all had strange break-ins happening to them. I'm going to talk specifically about Suna now because it's the most out there topic at the moment. Her tires were slashed on her car. The wheel nuts on her wheels were loosened most of the time when she got in her car. She was kidnapped and tied to a tree, and the felt was set on fire around her.
How did that not make news?
That's the thing.
That's terrifying.
The one thing that was quite important, and the only thing that sort of came out, and I looked at it last night, the only thing that came out was when she was shot in the face by someone with a pellet gun. And that wasn't the first time she had been shot at, actually. She'd been shot at before with, I think it was like a ceramic sort of bullet at a windshield or something like that. But she was shot in the face, and these pellets were embedded in her face. When she did go and report that to the police, the policeman said to her, no, it's domestic violence. She lived alone. And he didn't believe her that she had been shot in the face.
It's ridiculous. But even if it were domestic violence, it's illegal. Exactly. It's assault.
Exactly. And the thing is, I've had, and I'm probably going to piss off someone, but I had a journalist speak to me the other day and ask me, was she not making these things up? Because there's been rumors going around that she was making it up, because it hadn't been reported on. No one knew about it. There's a fucking dossier the size of my arm on all the incidents that had happened to her. On the last incident, it happened about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Tim, where is this dossier?
At the moment, it's sitting with the intelligence guys, because they may or may not suspect some sort of foul play. Okay. In her death. As far as I know, and what the family says, is that it was the heart condition caused from the stress of all of this that ultimately ended it.
All right. Sorry, but I interrupted you. So we're talking about the reporting of
the incidents. Yeah.
Of the incidents. I mean, I was unaware until she passed away, actually.
Yeah.
So was it reported on?
Yeah, she went to SAPS and she reported it to SAPS and to the intelligence guys. It was basically met with some most form of they ignored her, or they logged the reports and stuff like that, but nothing was really done about it. And the problem was, rumors were started by Claudia and co that she was unstable and that she was making these things up, and it kind of spread around, and a lot of these so-called journalists spread that around as well, and they made it worse, and now we sit with this narrative that she was possibly making that up, which is total bullshit, because I know the dossier is there, and it'll be available for people to look at, that she wasn't making it up. And that's the thing. I heard this from a colleague of hers, a fellow journalist, asked me if it was true. And he's not the only one that asked me that. There's quite a few spreading it around, because he must have heard it from someone else who heard it from someone else or brought it up, and probably brought it up at a memorial service yesterday too. And that makes it even worse. They're talking behind her back even after she's dead, and. Yeah, it just makes it worse. Oh.
Right. So do we know who assaulted her and kidnapped her and destroyed her property and stalked her?
No, we don't. All right. It's supposed to have been investigated, but
it never was. Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, you were in touch with her quite recently?
Yeah, regularly. The last time I spoke to her was let me check on my phone quickly.
Sure, I'm just trying to understand, you know, what her state of mind is. It's entirely possible that she died of the so-called broken heart syndrome, Takotsubo. Yeah. I don't want to get into speculation. Either way, that's what the family have said. I accept it. It just the incredible stress that she must have been under to for that to happen. It's quite a catastrophic sort of condition.
And yeah.
It is generally brought on by an incredible amount of personal stress and strife, in which your body essentially, physiologically, you're in a sort of fight or flight response permanently to cause that kind of damage to your heart, especially in such a young person. Was she sort of showing signs of it? Was she being very strong and just making as if she was coping, you know, because it sounds like she was a really very independent, strong person, who didn't let these things get to us. You know, someone who sort of goes over the border into Syria. You know, that's really is someone, as you said, who's quite brave and really doesn't let things get to them very easily.
Yeah, I mean, with her, she did so show signs of stress at times, but it didn't seem like it was getting to her to that point. I knew that she was unwell at one stage, and I actually checked up on her a couple of times just to see that she was okay. And she said, "No, look, I was fine. I'm fine." But the last incident, it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago. She said to me, "Oh no, there was a guy who brought a knife to a gunfight." And that was just her saying that she was a lot stronger than him. But she had noticed that the wheels on her car were rattling, so she stopped the vehicle to try and check to see if her nuts had been loosened yet again. And she was tightening them, and someone came up behind her and kicked her from behind. And there was a struggle that ensued with that. And I mean, that was the last incident. She never reported it because she had gotten to the point then with this last incident that, what's the point? No one's being found that's doing it to me. No one's being linked to this, that's giving the orders to do this.
Doesn't seem like anyone was listening to it anyway.
No one really gives a shit. And there are a few of us that did actually care. And I mean, I said to her many times, come down and come and spend some time here. If you ever feel unsafe or anything like that, give me a call and I'll arrange for you to have a safe place to stay where you can just have a break and whatever and get away from all this shit. Some of her colleagues she stayed with a couple of times after the incidents happened. But I mean, I suppose after such a long time of this constant pressure of over a year, death threats constantly, SMSs constantly. You'd think that an SMS would be able to be traced, and no one really did anything. And it goes back to this thing of the captured state. Yeah. Every crony is scratching another crony's thing, and there was this false sense of concern. You've got Uncle Figile at the moment now, making out like he's the super fucking top cop, and he's actually doing jack shit. We're concerned about your safety, Sina. Don't worry, we'll find it. And then sit and tweet about Floyd Mayweather or whatever. And that was the main problem. There were a lot of colleagues that had this false concern. They made like they were concerned, but actually didn't give a damn.
So is there a causal link? So it did start after she was reinstated at the SABC.
Yes.
So
yeah.
The protest, firing, court application, reinstated, then all this started, all the harassment and death threats and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so there's a clear link between her reinstatement and what happened to her.
Yeah, and many people, not really many people are saying it, that, and I said it the day I heard that she had passed away, and I said, Cloudy, this is on you. And I don't give a shit if Cloudy's listening right now. He directly or indirectly caused her death.
He's a big consumer of our show. He does come to us for decent content.
Does he know how to use podcasts? Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So anyway, sorry, you said.
Yeah. So I mean, it's there were a lot of things that could have been done to help her and the others that weren't done. Be it the legal people at the SABC that could have done something, the HR people that could have done something, her colleagues, and other journalists from other media houses too. When they spoke to her or saw her in passing and asked her how she was doing, they didn't say anything. Members of Parliament, she was at the SABC inquiry. They could have done more to assist it. They could have provide a protection for these people. If you see that people are getting death threats, you would think there would be some kind of protection program to see to it that these people are safe.
Yeah,
it wasn't done.
I find it so hypocritical because we've got we've got multiple situations, some of which deserve the response that they get, but we're hearing that there was no response here. So you've got Peter Bruce's house vandalized and demonstrated outside of under completely false pretenses, and the media loses their minds, and probably rightfully so. I mean, that's vandalism and destruction to property at minimum. And, you know, as I've said, in my opinion, Black Land First, or whatever they call themselves, are essentially a terrorist group. But the media loses their minds over something like that. We've had previous incidents where you get SANEF releasing statements, these sort of strongly worded statements, and everyone sort of comes out in support of X or Y. And every year when we have, you know, 16 days of activism, the two celebrities that we've spoken about amongst the journalists, many of them will virtue signal and say how important it is. So many of them go on ad infinitum about abuse of women or gender stereotypes or all this kind of stuff, rape culture, you know, these types of concepts. Here was an opportunity to actually get involved, to actually be part of helping a woman who was genuinely under attack. And it seems as if all of
these people failed. And she wasn't the only one. It was the other journalists too.
Yeah. So maybe let's talk about that a little bit. Is anything now being at least done? Are people going, all right, well, you know, one dead journalist, as Ramon said, a dead journalist in a liberal democracy. One dead journalist is one journalist too many. Perhaps we should look at what's happening to the other journalists and start taking this seriously.
I don't think enough is being done. A couple of years back, there was a protest happening in a small area in Somerset West behind where I was staying. It was literally 4 kilometers down the road from where I was staying, and I was at work and I heard that SANRAL was demolishing these people's houses because they wanted to build the toll road through the area. It was the Luandle evictions. Eventually, I became the only sole witness that was credible enough to give testimony at the Luandle Commission of Inquiry. But one of the journalists that asked me to come through, and she's a fantastic journalist. I think she's with AFP. I'm not sure if she's there anymore. But her name's Kristen van Skee. And Kristen van Skee is taught me more than a lot of journalists have taught me. And she taught me something in just one word. And she said that journalists run around looking for the bang bang. And I know you've seen the movie The Bang Bang Club. It's about journalism as well.
Yeah.
Journalists are always, and she told me about Marikana and what was happening, that all these journalists were looking for the bang bang happening at Marikana. But if they had stayed behind in the township itself to see what was happening with those people there, they would have picked up the biggest story and why the miners were striking and why they were doing what they were doing because of the conditions that they were living in and because of the salaries that they were earning. So these journalists, they run around, and I've used it a lot since then. These journalists run around looking for the bang bang. And that incident that happened with those thugs from Black First, Land First, or whatever, I don't even pay attention to them anymore. Mm. But that day, that was the bang bang. That incident of Peter Bruce being attacked, that was the bang bang. When Suna Fenta and the other SABC 8 were protesting, it was unprecedented. So that was the bang bang. But after a year, the bang bang dies out and they don't care anymore.
Yeah. I think
another example I'll give you is Shiraz Mohammed, the journalist that went disappearing, that went missing in Syria. He was kidnapped.
Mm.
That's how me and Suna became very good friends, because I was one of the very few that was trying to look for Shiraz and try and find out what had happened to him. And between the two of us, we worked well together to try and get information. And that was a huge story at the beginning of the year. It's been how many months now, and no one – you ask who Shiraz Mohammed is and no one cares.
Yeah, I sense an example as well that could be added is what Rion Milan wrote with regards to Coligny. You know,
he, that racist article.
He went, yeah, anything we don't like is racist. That word loses more meaning every single day, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, he went there and he wrote about the story behind this, as you mentioned, the bang bang. You know, yes. There were people burning houses, and there was a bail hearing, and that was the sort of, and it was a bit of a demonstration outside the courtroom. But really, the real story was all the stuff that had happened in lead up to that and around that within the community. And in that case, the victims were obviously the one guy who had died, who the other guys were on trial for, but also these sort of innocent bystanders who had their shops looted and their homes looted and been told to leave because they weren't welcome. It's just a very unfortunate state. Do you get the impression that there's just too much? Because, you know, like you mentioned, one story comes and it's a big story. And it should stay a big story. You've got a South African citizen who is a hostage in another country. I mean, that should be a big thing. And it gets forgotten about. Is it just there's too much? Is it too overwhelming? You know, nothing stays on the front page for more than 9 days?
No, nothing stays on the front page for longer than 2 days lately. I think there is. There's just so much instability at the moment in the country, and so much crap happening. There's so much corruption. There's so much crime. There's so much everything that you're right. It's not newsworthy for long enough to actually make an impact and make a difference if the story comes out. And key details get lost. Like Rian Milan said in his article, if someone had gone and checked for the other boy that ran away, and asked him what happened, and said to him, "Look, have you done this before? What happened before when you stole? I think was it Millie's or sunflowers?
Sunflowers.
Yeah. What happened the last time you got caught stealing sunflowers? Okay. Well, the uncle put us on the back of the bucky and he took us to the police station.
Yeah, and then they let us go with the warning.
And then they let us go with a warning because where's your mom and dad? Okay. Well, my mom. Let's say hypothetically, my mom's dead, and I live with my granny. That sort of stuff. People forget to look for those details now because there's this bigger picture. Now all of these people are protesting, and now it's racism, and a white guy killed a black kid, and it turned out to be that the kid tried to run at an intersection and he jumped off the bucky.
We still don't know.
Yeah, I think it's the court case, you know, still has to go ahead, which is also another problem with court cases is
no one's going to report
people,
on that.
People
court
get
case now.
Very emotional about these things. But no one really wants to wait for the facts to come out.
Abel Janssen is a prime example of that. No one wants the facts. Mabel Janssen, they crucified her, and she was alienated and everything. A year and a couple of months later, Kurabo Mokoena gets murdered, and all of a sudden men are trash. And then people that condemned Mabel Janssen and said she was a racist piece of shit or a racist bitch or whatever were jumping up and saying, "Oh, but Mabel was right."
Yeah, well, by that point, Mabel had lost her job or left her job, but we're not sure exactly the status. But the point is, someone who was, by all accounts, a good justice of the court.
Yeah, I mean, my big problem with Mabel Janssen or her case specifically, she has had no opportunity to give her context at all.
No, she hasn't.
Nothing at all. So how do we know what she meant? Because context is everything. These people that talk about things as if context doesn't matter are scum, absolute scum. And some of them happen to be journalists too, which is lower than scum. No, not really. But
which is strange. Facts. What happened to the facts?
Right.
Facts
and these are the same people that moan about fake news all the fucking time, right?
Yeah.
Burkis in fucking Frederberg follow Marula Media, which is like fake news, but they can't give any context to the stories that they're reporting on.
I don't think Marula Media is fake news at all.
No, I don't. That's the argument made. I can't read Afrikaans, but I heard they're pretty good. But that's what I'm saying. These people don't understand that they are the cause of fake news, and they are the cause of people not trusting authority, and they are the cause of people being doubtful about claims because they're the ones that make up these fucking things all the time.
Yeah, no, that's true, and it adds fuel to everything, and the unfortunate thing is they're going to be the cause of some sort of civil instability in this country too.
Which I think based on the glee with which certain events are covered, they'll be quite happy because it does at least seem to me that some journalists enjoy running from fire to fire. And it's quite funny because recently I don't know if it was Jim Acosta or one of the CNN journalists, I think, who compared all journalists to firefighters. So it's been a running joke on social media, when a journalist will like tweet something about, today we are doing this or we're doing that, or, of course in America it's hashtag resist, then, it'll be retweeted with it just like firefighters. it is interesting, but look, I still do believe journalists play a very important role. It'd be nice if the people you've described and mentioned, many of them by name, who really take their job very seriously as putting the facts on the page and the story on the page, and whether their name is acknowledged or not is beside the point. It's about telling the story as best as they can.
They're not running around trying to outwork each other. And there's a trend in South Africa. Everyone's trying to outwork each other with certain things. So you've got all these broflakes and snowflakes running around trying to outwork each other. And these journalists that I've worked with in the past, and they know who they are. If they're listening, you guys know exactly who are. Yeah. We are, because we're in contact. Even if there isn't a story, I'm in contact with them.
Right. And if they are listening, just know when we say journalists are lower than scum, we're not talking about you.
Yeah.
No, there seems to be a handful of journalists that I can't tolerate.
Indeed, but unfortunately they dominate the narrative all the time. And that's what irritates me the most. So much, they always say like the tallest tree catches the most wind or whatever the case might be. These people are not trees. They're fucking shrubs acting like they're trees. That's the problem.
The guys listening will probably think, yeah, but now I've probably buggered up my chances with these journalists. I don't speak to these journalists that have this bias or this agenda or their own personal egos. I don't contact them.
Let's talk about that quickly because – we've said on the show before that our view is there's no such thing as a truly objective human. You can try to be objective, and we have certain roles in society, judges as an example, who try to be objective. Lawyers might in certain instances try to be objective, but every one of us is influenced by our so-called lived experience, and so journalists are people. And so it's understandable that they may feel a certain way towards things. And the fact that you might apply for a job, for example, at the Mail and Guardian and not Marula Media might be because you feel that you just ideologically don't fit in with the more right side of politics that Marula Media would approach things, and you fit in with the Mail and Guardian, which is certainly the left side of politics and is becoming much more left on a daily basis. I don't view that as a problem necessarily. I just wish there was some honesty. And I suppose that it can possibly become an issue when the bias consumes the person. So yes. You can feel a certain way towards things, but you can still present both sides and go, look, this is what I view as being the correct way, but this was also presented, and you make up your mind.
It's not creating extremism, and that's what we're seeing.
Mentioned the woke people, if you're referring to yourself as woke, then you are taking on an exceptionally, there's no difference between saying I'm woke to saying I'm alt-right. Those are the same thing, just on different sides of the spectrum. And if you are saying you're woke, then you have no objectivity. And I wonder if anyone who describes themselves as that has a place in journalism.
Well, I mean, being woke is the new socialism. It's kind of strange. You've got the socialism comes as a thing, and then it disguises itself as democracy, and then turns into capitalism. Woke is just another term for I'm a bit of a socialist kind of ideals person, Marxist sort of thing. And it's just another form of extremism. And that's the problem. Also in South Africa, we're giving different names to the same thing. And it's exactly this. Our grandparents said it, or we saw it back then. We see it now. It's just in a different form.
Yeah. It's different iteration.
History repeats itself. It has to.
Unfortunately, because we got decolonized historical studies or something. Anyway, what is not woke? So, I mean, Tim, thank you. I mean, I think it's important for the listeners to understand that we don't hate every journalist. We hate most of them, especially the ones with lots of followers on Twitter.
Being hyperbolic.
You try to make the news. Except for you, Barry Bateman, you're pretty cool. Come on our show. Other than that, it's important for people to note, as we said three times now, it is not normal for a journalist to die from a medical condition brought upon by what you call utmost stress.
Extreme stress. Yeah.
Extreme stress. In a liberal democracy.
Believable.
If the allegations are true, there's a huge problem in South Africa, and we need to be wary of that.
No, definitely. And there's something that people need to remember, and I'm going to quote someone. It's in German. Als sie mich holten, gab keinen mehr, die protestieren konnte. They came for me, and there was no one left to protest.
Right. No, of course. Of course.
That's where we're sitting. They're going for the journalists now, but we're not journalists, so we didn't say anything.
Yeah, and other journalists aren't saying anything either. But nevertheless, what is not woke? So the last 10 minutes I want to talk about actually you are actually a metalsmith.
I'm a metalsmith now, yeah. After working with the union, I made the mistake of working for a political party in parliament, IFP.
you don't get to just cough that away. Because interestingly enough, if we took the tribalism out of it, the IFP are, from a political ideology perspective, have an incredibly liberal approach to politics. I could be, I see you like shaking your head a little bit, but in terms of some of the stuff I've read, is incredibly liberal.
Yeah, look, they've got some good members of parliament. Liesel van der Merwe is a very good, they're two young MPs, are really good MPs. They've got good ideas, but the tribalism is never going to be removed from it, because in essence, the IFP is a Zulu nationalist party. They are there for Zulu interests, and that it finished in klaar. Buthelezi is the prince. Is a prince in the Zulu nation, and he's the traditional advisor to the king of the Zulu nation. That is never going to be removed. His deputy now, the guy that's going to take over the party, is also a Buthelezi. It's all traditional. They believe in virginity testing for bursaries.
Yeah, all right, which is completely liberal, that's obviously.
So, I mean, I started working for the IFP, didn't agree with him. We didn't agree with each other, and we couldn't meet in between, and we decided to part ways. So I left there, and then while I was working for the IFP, I started doing Japanese fine metal work as a hobby, and ended up buying a lot of tools when I left the IFP and started. Someone said to me, "Well, to make some money, why don't you make me a Pokemon Go pendant?" They wanted a little Pikachu thing, so I cut it for them in silver, and then I started selling these things, and I noticed that it was paying the rent. So I carried on. I've always had a fascination with knives as well. So, I mean, I started making knives too. And
you got a website for this?
I've got a Facebook page. It's the Silver Atelier.
Okay.
A fancy word for workshop. And
it's a French word, actually. It's not fancy. It's just French.
Which makes nothing about the
French
is fancy.
It's very fancy.
but oh, fuck's sake.
Well done.
We're going to edit this out of the fucking podcast. But the reason why I would talk about smithing, I suppose that's what you call it, I have no idea, is that the world is going through a bit of a turmoil. Like there's a culture war going on between the globalists, right, and the nationalists. And I'm not calling you a nationalist by any means, but there seems to be...
Call me a civic nationalist.
Oh, you're a civic nationalist. Okay. So there seems to be a... People are nostalgic. They don't want like stuff made in China. Well, okay, they're not hipsters. I'm not talking about hipsters here. But they want something that's made within the vicinity of where they are, and there's something that's made to themselves, for themselves, which is against like the globalist agenda, so to speak. So
xenophobic. God.
Yeah, no, really much so. But that's what metalsmithing is about. I mean, you work only with your hands to create objects for people who give you an outline of what they want. So yeah. You custom make everything. And it's, yeah, I mean, what is the difference between that and buying a knife, I don't know, at Cape Union Mart?
Well, and the difference between a knife that I make and the one that's made at Cape Union Mart is that my one will be able to chop through a steel spike and you can still shave with it. Mass-produced blades and jewelry and stuff like that, it's, everyone knows that mass-produced means crap. There's not really good quality, long-lasting quality mass-produced stuff. People always talk about things in the old days being made better. If you had a Ford Cortina, you could drive into a brick wall and it would still run. Now you take a Ford Bucky, a Bantam, and you drive it through a brick wall and you kind of disintegrate with it.
Yeah.
So
there's a concept called planned obsolescence. Something is planned to fail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it, because it brings in money, and people remember, oh, I had this big name brand knife like Gerber, and it broke while I was chopping something with it. But I'll buy another one because it's a really good knife. But actually, it's they're feeding their own egos. They want that name brand associated with it. Yeah. So handmade stuff. There's, for example, I'm joining the American Bladesmiths Association quite soon, and after that you do an apprenticeship. And then you do your journeyman smith. And part of your journeyman smith's test is to make a knife that you can cut a rope with and then chop through two by 4-inch pine planks and then still shave with a blade. And then they take your blade and they clamp it into a vise and they bend it to 90 degrees and it doesn't break. So, I mean, it's high quality, really, really well-made stuff. And that's what bladesmithing and metalsmithing in South Africa is doing for a very small portion of us that are still practicing it, because it's a dying art.
Yeah, I can imagine it is. And a lot of these things are dying arts. But it certainly could be some sort of industry, you know, if there was investment towards that.
It's kind of developing its own economy on these Facebook groups and stuff like that. There's guys that will spend their last 3-4,000 rand on a blade that's custom made. There's one guy in particular I know. Every day he's buying 5-7,000 rands worth of knives from custom knife makers because he enjoys the quality of what he's getting, and he knows that later on in 20 years' time it's going to be investment because half of us are going to be paying, and his kids will have an investment plan because of something that's going to last 100 years.
Mm. Sure, yeah. Interesting.
Right, yeah, because I mean, my back in about a decade ago, we actually had custom made rifles made from a chap in Pretoria, and it was like Turkish oak for the stock. It was like a Mauser action. It was a certain steel compound for the bolt thing. It cost about 7 times a normal rifle, but when it's ready, fuck me, man.
Yeah, well, really custom good. Made is always.
Yeah. So just to talk about that in terms of entrepreneurship, I mean, that would be a good way to teach people who can't go to university or who can't get skills or who worry about fees must fall and all that shit. I mean, these are good skills to have for anyone who doesn't want to get a tertiary education, so to speak. Is there any sort of investment that, I don't know, the state or NGOs make to teach people how to actually use their hands in this way?
There's bursaries and stuff like that for people to do that sort of stuff. But in general, apprenticeships in handcrafting things, I know, for example, jewelry and knife making, it's very difficult to get an apprenticeship to do it because now a lot of jewelers are studying at university. They're not doing apprenticeships anymore. I was lucky enough to have someone that teaches me and that taught me the basics and got me off my feet. The same with the bladesmithing. There's local guys that are teaching me. But from government point of view, they shut down the teacher training colleges. They
increased minimum wage. Apprenticeships don't exist anymore.
they don't exist anymore. And my idea is with my business now in terms of entrepreneurship is to go and help people that need it, because it saved me when I lost my work. It saved me. So I want to be able to give them the tools to be able to do it themselves too. And I've always had the idea of, you know, the guys that are selling art on the side of the roads, like they do beadwork and stuff like that. Someone like that is very apt to do jewelry. They're very good with their fingers. They're very good with their hands. They'd be able to make fine pieces of jewelry because they're used to doing that sort of stuff. So my idea eventually in a year or two is to be able to employ someone, but someone that deserves it. Not these guys that are like, oh, I want a free education and I want a free degree and all that. They can go fuck themselves. I'm looking for someone who's actually trying to get off their feet and do something for themselves in life.
Awesome. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, Tim, that's where we will end.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us and talking about your friend who unfortunately passed away. And hopefully it's not the end of the story. In this saga,
no, it's definitely not the end of it. I've made it a personal mission of mine to see to it that justice gets served for what she had gone through.
Yeah,
yeah.
And well, I really hope it is. Happens.
All right, so Tim, where can we find you on Twitter? Are you on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. My Twitter handle is TIM_MEH. 87, so it's Timmer 87. Timmer, and then that's actually where it came from. University, they all call me Timmer, and then Instagram is Tim the Jeweler, and each word is separated by underscore, so Tim the Jeweler. And then on Facebook, my Facebook profile is private because that's a part of my life I want to keep private.
Sure.
So if you're a Facebook
we can
friend,
go follow you at the Silver Atelier, which is where you make all your jewelry and knives. And I've gone and had a look at that and some cool stuff there. So go take a look. A very cool sushi knife I see you selling.
Yeah, it's a Yanagi bar.
Very cool. Very cool. Right. Thank you so much for joining us. That's it for the week. As always, we want your money.
Yes, we do, actually.
Yeah, you almost forgot. Normally, you're so good at this. So, to start off with, there are several patrons who are already helping us to improve the Renegade Report. We are trying to hit a target, and we have certain things we'd like to do. There's a whole bunch of content. There's events being planned already that we are going to be offering to both listeners, but patrons will be given first dibs and discounts, if not freebies where we can. We'd like you to support the podcast. You can donate anything from $1 upwards.
Yep.
We cap it at $10. If you're prepared to give us 10 bucks a month, we're really grateful. And if you're prepared to give us $1 a month, we're really grateful. If you want to give it to us once off, cool, we'll take it.
Yeah.
Everything is welcomed. We are self-supported, self-funded.
And an important note, everything we receive goes back into the podcast. We don't make money from it. We're not going to use that money for anything else other than making the podcast better, expand the reach, host events, get some nice merchandise that we'll give away to people who want it, maybe fly in some guests, invite them over from overseas.
Yeah, so Jordan Peterson Live,
yes.
2019.
In studio.
So if you'd like to, you can find us on Patreon. You just search for the Renegade Report. Alternatively, there's a link on our Twitter handle, which is @Renegade_Report. You can find Roman at Roman Kavanagh and myself @Jonathan_Witt. Thank you so much for listening. Catch you next time. Cheers. Bye.
This is CliffCentral.com.